right track. Get on the 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 right track. How many ditches can you dig before the world is just a hole? And how long can you use that thing before it starts to take a toll?
Buy, sell, and trade new and used vinyl records at the Main Street Record Fair. With thousands of vinyl records for sale, you can discover gems and stock up on cheap classics. Join us Saturday, November 9th and Sunday, November 10th from 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. for vinyl spinning DJs, food truck goodness, prizes, discounts, and great deals on tons of vinyl records. For more information, visit vinylrecordfair.com.
Yes, so baby. Yes, oh baby. Yes, oh.
Convince America that more drilling is the answer. High gas prices? Drill more. Prices still high? Try drilling in a wildlife refuge or off a nice beach.
Our traditional energy resources are limited. Luckily, it's easy for students like you to conserve energy.
Woke up late for class? Buy some time in the morning by taking a shorter shower. Cut down by 1 minute every day and save enough to fund your daily caffeine fix for over a week. Plus, you save on electricity and water. Install a water-saving showerhead to save even more.
For more energy-saving tips, go to www.bchydro.com. This message brought to you by BC Hydro and CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver.
The UBC Ski and Snowboard Club is a non-profit, democratic, student-run organization dedicated to promoting the sports of skiing and snowboarding and the associated lifestyle.
We endeavor to make skiing and snowboarding accessible and fun by actively seeking out the best deals and discounts for our members, as well as organizing trips to local ski areas and setting up numerous social events.
Come on one of our legendary trips and explore the glory of riding in British Columbia. Or join us at the bar to discover the true meaning of debauchery. Ask your roommate, ask your parents, ask the RCMP. Who has the most fun at UBC? You'll get the same answer. The Ski and Snowboard Club.
Duh. Joining the Ski and Board Club is easy. Come by our office, sub 115, anytime with some money to become a member. Your membership gives you access to all the deals offered by our sponsors. Cheap beverages at our parties, an invitation to all club events, and of course, only members can come on the trips.
Yeah!
I don't know. gonna be round my vegetables. I'm gonna chow down my vegetables. I love you most of all, my favorite vegetable.
Sprouts. It's your 75-cent coffee fix in the sub.
It's your source for reasonably priced, creatively named stew and vegan brownies.
It's your purveyor of bicycle-delivered local produce.
It's also a place where volunteers can realize their vision of responsible business and where like-minded students can explore UBC's food systems.
Hark! Sprouts is currently accepting applications for next year's executive board and is encouraging ambitious, creative, and disciplined students from all faculties and year levels to apply.
Come by Sprouts in the sub-basement to learn more about our projects and how to get involved.
I tried to kick the ball, but my tinny flew right off. I'm red as a beet, 'cause I'm so embarrassed.
She'll make a lovely doll after I finish with you. I told you your webs were useless.
Spider-Man! He's melting!
It's too hot! It's too hot! Something must have hit the control lever. Turn it off!
Want to save energy and keep yourself comfortable? Turn down your thermostat 1 degree Celsius or consider installing a programmable thermostat. If every household in BC with electric space heating turned down their heat by 1 degree for 8 hours a day, it would save enough electricity to power science world for over 75 years. This Power Smart Play brought to you by BC Hydro Power Smart and CITR 101.9 FM.
Right here on News 101.
Right here on News 101.
What motivated you to become a candidate in the provincial election?
The media portrayal of last week's protest that resulted in polarizing images of black-clad activists taken to the streets.
He was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the Olympics.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective.
You're listening to News 101, Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced, student and community newscast, offering you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective.
Today is Friday, the 25th of October. I'm Talita Kelly.
And I'm Alistair Melling. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting you to you live from the University of British Columbia to our UBC campus, to the residents of Vancouver, and to the listeners of our newscast and podcast on our website, citr.ca.
Good evening, it's 5:09 p.m. and time for a full hour of independent campus, local, and international news, as well as news from around the world brought to you by Democracy Now! And Free Speech Radio News.
Okay, and plus your weekday and weekend weather forecast, weekend weather forecast, brought to you by Environment Canada.
Today's top stories are segments by Thomas Borsa. his report on the involvement of the Line in the Sand project and an interview with Professor Scott Anderson on rape culture.
As well as my own report on the recent interview between Jeremy Paxman and Russell Brand, and a new segment by news correspondent Morame, all about what you would do if you were in the place of someone who was recently newsworthy. Okay. And today's hot topic, what impact do you think the free trade agreement between Canada and the EU will have?
But first, your campus local and national news headlines.
Okay. Our first report comes to us from Thomas Borsa, a correspondent who is involved in the Line in the Sand project, a collaborative multimedia project which aims to provide an alternative outlet for the sharing of opinions and personal testimony concerning the North Gateway. Thomas writes, am I reading that? Yeah. Established in 2012, we have travelled from one end of the proposed pipeline's route to the other, from, how do you say that,
Bruderheim.
Okay, fine. Alberta, to Katimat and BC, and will continue to visit communities throughout BC until mid-November. Our final schedule stops will be in Smithers, Prince Rupert, Haida Gwaii, is that correct? Okay. And Hartley Bay. Not Canadian, unfortunately. We are currently composed of 14 members. Thomas Borsa, writer and project co-director, studied at University of Saskatchewan. Jean-Philippe Marquis, photographer and videographer, studied at Concordia and l'Université de Montréal. I don't know how to say that. Part. And Skylar Flaville, videographer, studied at Capilano, and Tristan Becker, photographer, studied at the University of Saskatchewan and currently at UBC. Together we are working with towards the production of a coffee table book compiled from the many interviews, testimonials, and photographs, etc., shared with us to date, and a short documentary. We have recently launched a Kickstarter campaign, and our website is www.lineinthesand.ca. And apparently they update their blog, which can be found on the site frequently. Line in the Sand was established for the following reasons: to test whether regional differences in opinion between Alberta and British Columbia were indeed as stark and concrete as was claimed but in the mainstream reports of the issue. Also to provide an overview of the nature of arguments in favour and or against the pipeline, i.e. for what specific reason we people in Smithers, for example, so unanimously oppose the pipeline. Conversely, for what specific reasons were people in the central Alberta apparently not so in favour of it. Also to explore whether the understanding of the risks involved with the Northern Gateway differed to any considerable degree between the Indigenous and non-Indigenous peoples of Canada, and also to underscore the human side of the North Gateway through dialogue with and immersion in the lives of individuals living directly along the pipeline, the proposed route of the pipeline. Most importantly, to provide an alternative vehicle, i.e. external to the Joint Review Panel, for interviews, living along the proposed route, to have their voices and concerns heard and broadcast to the broader public. So I would say this is because this became the case, particularly after the passage of the Bill C-38, which I know means nothing to you, which imposed time limits and restricted the number of people allowed to provide testimony at public hearings. Thank God that's over. And now we're joined by Talita.
On a similar note, the violence and arrests at an anti-fracking protest on Thursday of last week sparked a number of protests across Canada. The issue is complex, involving both the duty of drilling companies to consult with Aboriginal people when intending to develop land that has been traditionally theirs, as well as concerns about the process of fracking itself. It is interesting to note that the duty to accommodate the wishes of Aboriginal groups has a legal precedent. Lower courts and the Supreme Court of Canada have established this duty through their passing rulings. In addition, New Brunswick's First Nations never ceded their land to the government. The only treaties signed by the local Mi'kmaq and Maliseet were the of peace and friendship. No rights to land or resources were ever surrendered. Protests have sprung up across the country in support of the original protesters, a sign that this issue surrounding in the development of natural resources are felt throughout Canada. And those are your UBC campus local...
We have one more.
Way down. And this is contributed by...
Sarah Khan.
And specifically, do you know what it's about?
It's Women's History Month.
Women's History Month is the topic for this one. And we're going to play a little segment to you.
Reading it.
Okay, we are. I'm just going to read it. And where exactly may I find this? Okay, here we are. In honour of the Women's History Month, the City of Vancouver's Women's Advisory Committee and Urban Aboriginal People's Advisory Committee organised a sharing of stories of reconciliation last Thursday, October the 17th. Or 17th of October, preferably. The following guests were invited to speak at the event. Christy Lee Charles, who is a Musqueam, leader and performer. Winnie Cheung, director of Vancouver Asian Heritage Month Society. Loretta Todd-Cree, and Métis, who is a Métis film manager?
Métis.
Oh dear, so much French this day. Digital media producer and community leader. Lillian Borax Nemitz, a child supervisor for, of the Warsaw Ghetto, and Vancouver Holocaust Education Center outreach speaker. At the sharing, guests shared their personal experiences of facing prejudice and explored the meaning of reconciliation and what it means to them.
And that those were your local and international news headlines. We're going to take a quick PSA break, but stay tuned.
Lucky.
That ship out there will be smashed to bits. Use your emergency equipment.
It won't work. Nothing works. It's got to. It's no use. Everything seems to be stuck.
My life's worth a try anyway. Come on, fellas. You can make it.
Just listen to this. Spider-Man saves freighter. You can't tell me the captain couldn't have brought his ship in without the help of that publicity-seeking show-off, Spider-Man!
Don't get caught wasting power. Unplug cell phone, camera, and other battery chargers when charging is complete. Many electronic devices continue to use power even when you are not operating them. The amount of energy consumed by electronics in a year when they were not in use could power Whistler Blackcomb Resorts for 43 years. This Power Smart play brought to you by BC Hydro Power Smart and CITR 101.9 FM.
Zines, magazines, books, art, crafts, readings, performances, lectures. Do you like these things?
Yeah.
Do you like when these things are made by indie artists in your community?
Yeah.
Then come on down to Canzine West, the greatest festival of zine and independent culture, brought to you by Broken Pencil Magazine, on Saturday, November 2nd from 1 to 7 p.m. at the Ukrainian Hall at 805 Pender Street East.
Welcome back to News 101. You are listening to us on CITR 101.9 FM or online at citr.ca. Broadcasting live from the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. Thank you for being with us.
We now have your local weather forecast for the weekend.
My name is Alex. I'm on the boards today, and I'm going to be doing the weather. Tonight, we have cloudy conditions with a 40% chance of drizzle and foggy patches coming through with fog at midnight, low of 8. On Saturday, it'll be cloudy with a 40% chance of drizzle early in the morning and fog again becoming fog patches in the morning, a high of 12. Saturday night, it'll be cloudy, and Sunday, it'll be sunny, thankfully, with a high of 13.
Thank you, Alex. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9. Our first segment of the show, first official segment, is an interview with Professor Scott Anderson on the rape culture. Yes? Mm-hmm.
Sorry, folks, it looks like we're having minor technical difficulties, but there we go.
Weeks have seen various forms of action taken by groups around campus to ensure that those with concerns for their... On the UBC campus, tensions have been high as three women have made reports of being sexually assaulted. The campus has so far sent out email alerts, given tips to women on safety, and increased security. In addition to these, the past few weeks have seen various forms of action taken by groups around campus to ensure that those with concerns for their safety are heard. UBC Professor Scott Anderson gave a talk on Tuesday titled, "What Happens on the Bus Doesn't Stay on the Bus: The Reproduction of Coercion and Rape Culture." This talk centered on the social normalization of rape and looked at why things such as the rape chant done during Frosh Week, as well as these sexual assaults, have become standard practice. Sitting down with Professor Anderson, I was able to ask him a few questions concerning his thoughts on rape culture.
So, I am here with Professor Scott Anderson, who recently gave a talk entitled "What Happens on the Bus Doesn't Stay on the Bus: The Reproduction of Coercion and Rape Culture." Hello, Professor Anderson.
Thanks for coming by.
Thank you for having me. So, first of all, you defined rape culture as the normalization of rape. Could you explain a little bit about that, please?
Okay. Because culture is such a difficult and broad word that people have different ideas about, I think I'm not defining it so much as I'm just trying to specify a little more carefully what I wanted to talk about. So when I say the social normalization of rape, what I have in mind is the idea that a lot of people might either consciously or unconsciously simply come to accept that men committing sexual assault or rape against women is something that is natural, normal, and essentially unavoidable, at least to a large extent. I mean, obviously it can go up and down, and different cultures have different rates of this sort of thing, but accepting that this is just the way things happen then has all sorts of consequences for how people will think to distribute responsibility, to So when people take it for granted that men are going to commit sexual assault against women in large-scale fashion, this has an effect on how people think they have to lead their lives to protect against it, how they distribute responsibility for when it happens, and a sense as to whether or not somebody is to blame because they didn't take precautions of a certain sort.
Speaking of blame, victim blaming has become a prevalent part of rape culture. Do you feel that warnings such as, you know, walk with a friend, don't go out late at night, and, you know, be conscious of the way you dress, do you think that those warnings contribute to victim blaming?
I think that they do. I think it's a complicated relationship, and it's not, when one person says it, that doesn't necessarily mean that somebody else ends up changing their behavior. But when there's a general attitude that it's up to women to protect themselves rather than up to men to either change their behavior or to prevent other men from doing this to women, that then it does affect the sense as to who's responsible for sexual assault when it occurs. And so, even though there's a natural and understandable desire to want to give people advice that if they follow it, they would be safe if they followed it, I think that this kind of advice has a sort of pernicious subtext sometimes, and sometimes it's more disguised than others, but it's something that I think we ought to be extremely cautious about doing. And so if I were to give an example of how to do this properly, I would look at an essay that was just published in the New York Times today by a philosopher named Louise Antony, who very carefully couches this advice in the kind of warnings that I've just given, but notes that it's advice that should be given to both men and women, and that it's on a par with other kinds of advice about, say, how to take care of oneself in general, health-wise and otherwise. It doesn't necessarily mean that if someone fails to follow this advice that they are to be blamed for what somebody else does to them.
All right. So you're saying to move past kind of it's the responsibility of a woman to ensure that she doesn't get attacked, that we should incorporate just general safety into our everyday lives, kind of, and make it gender neutral.
Yes.
Okay. So you're discussing how, you know, with normalization, it doesn't mean that people are insensitive or not understanding of the seriousness of rape. So I'm asking, people who are not ignorant of the seriousness of rape, why then do they trivialize rape?
Well, I actually think that the social normalization of rape does involve a kind of trivialization. That is, that if this is something that happens frequently and something that a lot of people can just have to expect, that's a way of saying, well, this is not something that we can change, so the best response to it is to not take it so seriously. And I think that's obviously a problematic response when it turns out that this does affect so many people so strongly. So how does trivialization occur? Well, I mean, it's because there are really different stakes in this, and the people who are in a position to sort of set the agenda and determine what matters to people tend to be those who are either men or those who are allied with their sort of values, such that they're the ones that are best able to protect themselves or least likely to suffer from this. And so when other people do, they don't necessarily have the same sense of empathy or sense of identification with those that are subjected to this.
Hmm. And also concerning rape, you mentioned power dynamics between gender, and I was wondering how you think those gender power dynamics present themselves in other cultural situations. Someone at the talk mentioned jail, for instance. What is it about that dynamic that makes, you know, male and female distinctions so prevalent?
That's a long and complicated answer to give. I think that it has historical roots in a few things. So the fact that men have historically been more powerful than women physically and have, for various reasons, developed a sense of sort of solidarity amongst men in contradistinction to women, since this is a fairly natural dividing line amongst population groups, has allowed them to monopolize lots of different parts of social power. So monopolize the economy, monopolize ownership of natural resources, monopolize access to and participation in the state, use this to, in various ways, divide women into the private sphere where they are much less well positioned to form common cause, to fight back, and to have the kind of economic wherewithal to turn the tables against men. Historically, that has been, I think, at least part of the explanation, though there are examples of cultures where this hasn't been the case. But since the development of agriculture, this has been a fairly common situation. It is, however, in the modern economy where physical labor is no longer either particularly well paid or the best and only way to access economic resources. It has become much easier for women to compete equally or even outcompete men in some fields. And it's also, I think, a bit of a testament to civilization that we now are much less likely to solve many of our disputes through brute force and violence against one another. We now manage to solve these disputes through courts and other forms of dispute resolution that are not necessarily better suited, or where men are not the only people who are in charge of them, or the only people who can mete out the punishments either. So I think that that does make it much more feasible for women to demand equality and for society to be organized in a way that can treat people according to something other than their physical strength or ability to do physical labor, and that I think makes it possible for women's equality to become much more easily obtained. It isn't obtained yet, but that's something that I think you could imagine occurring under current modern circumstances.
And there have been recent attacks on campus by an individual. Three girls were attacked, and UBC recently would release emails. Mm-hmm. Do you think that's an effective way of kind of alerting people to these attacks, or do you think something more drastic should have been happening?
I don't know that I have an answer to that. I suspect that almost everybody was aware of this after at least the second attack, but I really don't have evidence of that one way or the other. I think that it is extremely unfortunate that there is this individual out there engaging in these attacks, but I think that it is because it is relatively unusual compared to the way most sexual assault occurs, which is through acquaintances or under the influence of alcohol or between intimate partners and so forth, that occurs so much more frequently than stranger assaults do, that it's the stranger assaults that generate a lot of attention and public pushback, when in fact the much greater dangers to most women are people that they already know and who, when they attack, very rarely get media attention. So, I mean, certainly I would hope that they apprehend and this particular individual soon, but if I were a woman on campus, I probably wouldn't alter my patterns of behavior very much, because statistically this sort of attack is, even when there is one on the loose, a fairly unlikely occurrence for that person. So I'm not encouraging anybody to take extra risks than they would already, but I also wouldn't encourage people to radically alter their lifestyle right now, because that's not a realistic, I think, threat to the thousands of women who are living here and walking around safely almost all hours of the day anyway, even when there is one sort of random attacker on the loose.
Mm-hmm. And to those people who say that they are just joking when they make, you know, comments or jokes about sexual assault, how do you think that, other than going towards like trivializing rape, do you think that desensitizes us as well to when we hear about these attacks?
I think it has some role in that. I mean, it depends on the joke, but I mean, certainly the kind of thing that was chanted by the Commerce undergraduate students during Frosch Week seemed to be insensitive to the nature or prevalence of this kind of problem, and so it doesn't convey that this is taken seriously. It conveys exactly the opposite, and I think that one can see in the response of the students themselves, after sort of having their consciousness raised to the issue, I think the kind of shame and unhappiness on the parts of many of the people who engaged in this testifies that, in fact, they weren't taking something that was very serious as seriously as they should have.
Okay, and last question. Do you think that it's possible to become oversensitive to something like this?
Well, I'm sure that it is. I think that it is not common. but I think we should worry about that if and when it happens. not preemptively, however.
Do you think it would be, like you said, if and when it happens, do you think that, you know, people would start taking these cases more seriously soon? Or do you think it's still going to be kind of, oh, it happened, let's move on? And then the behavior not changing.
I mean, I am a long-term optimist on this, but I don't think that things move fast in this domain, or at least I don't see any evidence of rapid change here that gets ahead of, say, the technology and the society more generally. But who knows? I mean, there has been if you look at, say, this is not the same issue at all, but you look at attitudes towards gay marriage in North America, it went from being something that almost nobody could fathom to being something that there's now almost or actually a majority of sentiment in favor of it in the United States in the matter of a very few years. So sometimes when attitudes start changing, they change very rapidly, and it goes from something that's inconceivable to something that everybody took for granted. It's conceivable that this will happen in this area as well, but so far I don't see evidence that's likely to happen in the near future. But I'm not a good prognosticator of many things, and so I will not make too many guesses about this.
Okay, thank you very much for your time.
You're welcome.
I appreciate it.
Thanks for the interview.
Thank you very much for that piece, Talita. And
we are going to take a quick PSA break, so please stay tuned for more contributor segments.
Oh my. Become a friend of CITR and get great discounts on Commercial Drive and in other areas at
Bone Rattle Music, High Life Records, People's Co-op Bookstore, Audiopile Records, Bad Bird Media, BAM Merch Canada, and the Vancouver Music Gallery.
Wow, it sure does pay to be a friend of CITR. To find out more, visit us in room 233 of the sub on the UBC campus, or go online to www.citr.ca.
Keep smiling, keep shining. That's what friends are for.
Do you need someone to talk to? If you are seeking a listener who is non-judgmental, confidential, and familiar with resources, then a Speakeasy volunteer might be able to help you. AMS Speakeasy is a peer support service located in the North Concourse of the sub. If you would like to speak to someone, come to the desk and tell a volunteer, or ring the doorbell located behind the desk.
And welcome back to News 101. I am Alistair.
And I'm Talita. You are listening to us on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting live from the University of British Columbia in Vancouver, or online at citr.ca. Thank you for being with us.
Next up on the show, we have Mormay's debut, which is titled In Their Shoes. And we'd like Alex to play the segment.
Hello, and welcome to the very first segment of In Their Shoes, where I ask students on the UBC campus what they would do if they were a certain political figure or celebrity recently in the news. So this week my question was, if you were Prime Minister of Canada, would you implement universal daycare? This question has been brought up in the news lately with the recognition of Quebec's daycare system, which allows sending your child to daycare for only $7 a day, compared to other provinces, which can be up to $2,000 a month, which is extremely pricey. However, This is a very controversial question, and talking to students on campus, it's become clear that this is an issue that won't easily be settled. Some are for it, some are against it, and some just don't know.
I'm Lucy, and if I were the Prime Minister of Canada, I would implement it, mm-hmm. because I think already enough that's too much money for the, especially like the low-income people. It's quite important that kids are looked after and that they don't have to deal with the struggles of finding a babysitter every time.
Lucy brings up some good points there, and she's definitely not alone in her opinion. Some people do believe that the government should intervene, whether that means a full subsidization or partial subsidization. Navpreet and Stephanie had something to say about this.
I don't think that universal daycare should be implemented per se, but I think the government could definitely subsidize it to help people out that are struggling in affording that kind of stuff, especially when they need it to like work and everything.
Ideally, it would be a good system to have in place, because families nowadays take different shapes. So there's lots of single parents and like, yeah, you know what I mean. And so I think it's like necessary to have that crutch in place.
Those two ladies certainly have some good opinions there. I like what Stephanie had to say about providing a crutch for a single woman who don't know how to support their children. That was a very strong point indeed and really got me thinking. That being said, there are two more gentlemen who were sort of on the fence with this question and didn't really know what to think about it. And so that was Greg and Paul, and let's hear what they have to say.
No, I'm not going to have an opinion.
Oh, how come you don't have an opinion?
Because it is important to have a traditional family where there are a certain number of parents that are engaging the child on multiple different levels. But then removing that choice between having daycare and just having normal parenting shouldn't be made by the government. It should be made by the individual. And so maybe the government should be doing something to increase that level of choice, or maybe they should leave it more closed.
Well, if I were the Prime Minister, I would probably not want to spend the budget on that. But as a concept, it's a good idea. But it runs the risk of putting a lot of daycare businesses out of jobs, because I already know several families who own daycare businesses and wouldn't go so well for them. So economically, it could help because it would free up, I guess, house people to work in the workforce. But on the other hand, there are a lot of daycare businesses, so that might disrupt the economy a bit.
Those two guys definitely had some good points too. Sometimes having an opinion is the easy way out, so seeing it from both sides is important, and I think they had very informative responses and got their points across pretty well. Some people simply said
no.
I asked one person with this opinion to delve into this further so I could understand their point of view, and Brett had this to say.
I don't know. I'd have to think really carefully if I was in the president's shoes or the prime minister's shoes.
Yeah.
Right now, I would say no. Being a university student and thinking about what I want to be spending my money on right now, not having any kids, I don't think universal daycare would be something that I'd want to be putting towards or putting my taxes towards.
Right, yeah.
And so I think that's affecting how I would view it if I were the Prime Minister. But that's a really tough question. I really don't know what to answer.
Brett is definitely right about that. This is an extremely tough question. We saw how many different points of view there were. Everyone had some really great points, and it was so much fun this week on In Their Shoes, and I can't wait to do it again next week. Thank you so much, and hope you enjoyed listening.
Thank you to Mormay for that. Up next, we have the Student Hot Topic this week. Christine talks to students about what impact students think the free trade agreement between the EU will have with Canada.
Welcome to this week's segment of the Hot Topic. Last Friday, Mr. Harper formally unveiled the announcement that the EU and Canada has opened talks on a free trade agreement. Ottawa says this deal is, quote, biggest, most ambitious, end quote, trade agreement in Canadian history. It's predicted that the deal will eliminate 98% of EU tariffs and offer opportunities to an array of industries across the country. For this topic, I went over to Buchanan Tower instead of down at the Student Union building and got a couple of statements from professors of all different fields. Each of them had something different to say, so here are the statements.
Hi, so what's your name?
Kyle Frackman.
What impacts do you think this free trade agreement will have, positive or negative, between Canada and the EU?
I think there's a potential for continued cultural collaboration, which as someone in a cultural studies field that looks at members of the European Union and members outside of the countries outside of the European Union, I think that there's the potential for increased visibility of some of the countries in the EU from the Canadian perspective, and I think that socially and internationally, culturally, and so on, it could potentially benefit us. So the exact terms of the economic agreement I wouldn't be able to comment on, but I think that increased visibility, I think, can often be a very good thing.
Do you think that this in any way will degrade Canada's culture because it's becoming more open and more like integrated with the EU's?
I think Canada already makes a lot of different connections with other countries around the world, including China, the United States, obviously, Mexico. I think that this Canada already has a lot of connections to the cultures in the European Union and the many various countries in the European Union. So I don't think that it would be necessarily a negative development.
All right, thank you so much for
your
time.
You're welcome.
Hi there. So what's your name?
My name is Stephen Talbanek. I'm an associate professor of German at UBC, and I've been here since 1992.
Awesome. So what impacts do you think the recent free trade agreement between Canada and the EU will have, positive or negative?
As I understand it, the arrangement is complicated. It looks like a good PR move for Stephen Harper and the Conservative government, but it also looks like the results could be mixed for local, say, BC, say, cheese producers, dairy farmers, and so forth. It also looks like there could be mixed effects for other sectors of the economy. So we'll just have to see how the various legislatures respond. As I understand it, it has still not been approved by the different legislatures. So, and I'm assuming through the negotiation there will be changes in the arrangement. So I think the idea of having a more open agreement with Europe is in theory good, but in practice has a lot of issues with it. If I may just speak to the question of cheese, which is one of the most interesting issues. Cheese prices in this country, in Canada, are fairly high. And the possibility is now, for example, if you take French cheese or Swiss cheese, that even German cheese or Italian cheese, that the Canadian market could quickly be flooded by very cheap forms of very high quality cheese coming from Europe. Which may have a serious negative effect on local cheese producers. There is a cheese industry in British Columbia, and I'm not sure what the effects of that will be overall. So, in other words, it's a mixed picture. I think there's some benefits. I'd say the overall benefits are potentially there and good, but could also have negative effects, and I think the government especially should be honest and forthcoming about why it's made the arrangements it has, and we'll have to see.
Do you think that the Harper government, before openly agreeing to this agreement between the EU, do you think they should have, I guess, taken more of a consensus on the public and the legislators, especially with this whole cheese producers controversy too? Do you think the Harper government overstepped?
The Harper government, in my view, now this is just my view, and I'm not in political science, But in my view, the Harper government is secretive, does not consult, does not get involved with the people in this country at all, let alone sufficiently. I think they should have had far more consultation, far more discussion with different economic sectors, discussion not only with the premiers, but also with economic leaders around the country. As I understand it, they moved out ahead. In fact, I think the Harper government timed this to offset the news about the Senate scandal. And so I think it's a fair bit of a PR show on their part to try and bring in some good news while the Senate is blowing up all around them.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for your time.
Is that it?
Yes. Okay. Awesome.
Unfortunately, due to time constraints, we're going to have to cut that off there. But if you would like to hear the full recording with Christine, we will be playing it for our Monday show, so tune in at 5 p.m. for that.
Our final contributor piece comes from News 101 correspondent Alistair on the recent interview between Jeremy Paxman and Russell Brand.
Thank you very much, Talita. Now, this immediately caught my attention. This was an interview released on Wednesday, pre-recorded, between Jeremy Paxman and Russell Brand, both British called celebrities, I'm not sure, but certainly Russell Brand, much more well-known in the US. Jeremy Paxman is a very famous part of the BBC, British Broadcasting, British Broadcasting, and he's very, very famous for giving tough interviews, which he attempted somewhat, and this has been all across the blogs, newspapers, all commenting about this, because Russell Brand, who's not really known too well for his political views, more, I don't know, his marriage to Katy Perry, he came out with a sort of torrent of political views, and he voiced very much his dissatisfaction with the current system. Basically, it started off, I want to finish this with, he raised, there were a couple of main themes throughout the interview, mainly, if you do not vote, do you have any authority to voice a political opinion? And the other one is about the coming sort of revolution that we saw. I don't know if you want to call it revolution, but certainly the stuff that was started off with it, with Occupy Wall Street movement, and generally the local dissatisfaction with what our political system has shown itself to be. So it starts off basically the interview. Paxman directly asked Brand, why do you have any authority? Because he's very much vocal. Brand came out very vocally in a recent article for the New Statesman, which is a British magazine, stating that he did not vote and he did not see any point in voting because that tacitly complies with the current system. And he straight off the bat, he asks Paxman questions and why anybody should listen to him because for the fact he does not vote. He does, I believe, Russell Brand gives sort of brushes it off at the beginning with somewhat of a I don't know what exactly word you would use, but in jokes around and says that he got involved in it because he was politely asked by a rather attractive woman. It does then continue a little bit with Brand being a tiny bit not childish, but dodging questions with a few of jokes, but then when Paxman calls him a very, very trivial man, I think that's when you see Brand changing, and his maybe frustration drives him to be not rash in any sense, but he comes out with a long rant, quite precise, and I think his grammar was actually reasonably impressive. Comes up with very, very sophisticated argument. However, I do believe one thing I would criticize Brand on, mostly the magazines and the blogs have praised him for his way that he dealt with Jeremy Paxman's questions. But I do believe that he, as so often with most utopianists, he didn't manage to present generally just criticize a system whereby you don't actually present your own arguments. What would you replace the system with? So I think maybe, to be fair, it was only a 10-minute interview. Definitely I recommend watching it. And I think one of the comments was by the Telegraph, most politicians don't lay a glove on Paxman, but Brand made him look rather uncomfortable and faintly ridiculous. So it's definitely an interview I'd recommend you guys watching. But I wanted to extend the question to, we can call them our panelists today. So do you think, first question, this is a theme that went on throughout, do you believe that members of society have any authority or any reason to be taken seriously if they refuse to vote? Now,
well, this is Morgan. I've been in the studio just making sure everything was running a little smoothly. but no, I totally do not support that statement. I think that if you do not vote, you lose the right to question a lot of what goes on. I mean, I understand his point about, you know, implicitly supporting the current system if you vote, but at the same time, if you're not going to vote, it's very difficult for anyone to take you seriously if you're going to criticize it, because you're not even, you're so far outside of the system. Okay. And I know a lot of people who don't vote just on principle. They're like, oh, stuff's so bad, I don't want to vote. But that means you're, like, by being passive in not voting, you're allowing for things to just continue on how they are. So unless you're going to be super radical, I mean, I don't understand the logic there.
Okay, that's very much of the opinion that was voiced by Paxman. Do you want to have anything to contribute to that, Alex?
So this is Alex here on the boards, and I just wanted to talk about how this is actually a pretty long-standing issue, this idea of whether or not you should participate in a government that you fundamentally disagree with. The philosopher Immanuel Kant actually brings this up in one of his essays, and I'm not gonna quote him because, honestly, I'm not that smart. I can't memorize what he's talking about. And he uses quite a few confusing terms. But to paraphrase Kant, what his essential idea was is that you have a private life and a public life. And though you are totally allowed to voice your disapproval with a system or with a law in your, you know, in your public life, in your private life, you still have to abide by those laws. You still have to operate within that system. Mm-hmm. And so I believe, to apply that to what we're talking about now, that just because you disagree with our current system, which, by the way, I sort of do, it doesn't forgive you from participating in it. It's not like if you disagree with a law, you can just stop abiding by that law. And by the same token, if you disagree with the way that the government is set up, with the way that your votes are counted in the system that we're operating in, it doesn't mean that you don't have to vote or that you shouldn't vote.
Okay, and now we're joined by Sarah, who would like to voice her own opinion. So, there we are.
I'd just like to say that it's a lot difficult to find a completely different system to work within. It's a lot easier to work within a system that you already have because it provides a certain level of stability and it allows you to work on specific issues, and that's what we need to do.
Okay, and just to add my own opinion, I think he very much had a point where right now Osborne, who's our Chancellor of the Exchequer, and David Cameron, they're currently in Brussels right now for trying to fight for the rights of British bankers to retain their bonuses. Now, I think when you have a government that is deliberately organized to fight and defend the rights and profits of the upper class, I think that's when they're totally disconnected from the lower class, which they clearly are in the UK. I think that is when you've got a case where you are, if you vote, you are to tacitly support that.